State of Hawaii is reconvened. Please be seated.
Hold case, please.
Case number 28571, State v. Vinhaka. Arguing for the petitioner, William Jameson. Arguing for the respondent, Tracy Murakami. Argument on the merits.
Mr. Jameson.
Thank you. May it please the court. Madam Prosecutor. This morning, I am before this court asking it to review the decision of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, specifically on three issues. However, I'd like to say at the outset, I would like to devote the bulk of my argument mainly to two instead of three issues. The three issues before this court that was raised in the petition were whether or not the ICA was correct when it held that the court below did not commit error when it found that the prosecution had made sufficient efforts to establish the unavailability of the young lady by the name of for purposes of subsequently attempting to introduce her preliminary hearing testimony. The second issue that was raised in the petition was whether or not the ICA was correct when it held that the court below did not commit error when it found that there had been adequate opportunity for the defense to cross-examine at the preliminary hearing. And then, of course, the third issue is the issue of whether or not there had been misconduct committed by the prosecuting attorney in her closing argument when she essentially seemed to imply that, at least on our point of view, that the defense attorney had possibly coached the complainant into changing her testimony and retracting what she said at the preliminary hearing. I would like to devote the bulk of my argument to the first two issues. Specifically, I'd like to start and give this court some background as to how we got here. We are here because it started out as an appeal from a judgment that was entered against petitioner on April 30th, 2007 by the Fifth Circuit Court. He was initially charged with 16 counts. In counts 1, 2, and 3, he was charged with sexual assault in the third degree of his daughter. In count 4, he was charged with assault in the second degree of his daughter. In counts 5, 6, and 7, he was charged with abuse of family or household member involving. In counts 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, these were charges of sexual assault in the third degree against a daughter. In count 13, the charge brought against him was attempted sexual assault in the first degree. Count 14, it was sexual assault in the first degree. And then 15 and 16, it was charged that he had committed abuse of family or household member against his daughter. Now, I'd like to say at the outset, just to give this court understanding of the facts, that all of the charges with respect to abuse of family or household members were was dismissed at the motion for judgment of acquittal. Okay, so after the case went to trial, the defendant was convicted of everything. Now, what happened in this case is at the preliminary hearing, the complainant essentially testified that her father had touched her breast, that her father had placed his penis against her vaginal area with their clothes on, and she also testified that her father had put his mouth on her breast, and she also testified that her father had hit her with a wrench in her head when she was helping him to fix the car, and he was angry at her because she had not cleaned the wrench adequately. The next part, the also testified at the preliminary hearing, and she essentially testified that her father had touched her breast with his hand, touched her buttocks with his hand, touched his vagina with his hand, placed his mouth on her vagina, placed his penis against her vagina, I believe with her clothes on, and that he tried to insert his penis into her vagina, and that he had also inserted his finger into her vagina. Now, the reason I talk about all of this is because this is the issue in this case. At trial, what happened was essentially recanted. And I believe that properly so, the prosecuting attorney was allowed to bring into the court the prior statements that had been made at the preliminary hearing under 802.1, I believe. The problem arose when it was clear that he was not going to be appearing at the court. In order to prove that he was unavailable, the state presented the testimony of a social worker for the Department of Health, who basically testified that she had custody of, that she had received a subpoena from the prosecuting attorney's office on January 25th of 2007, but she was not able to comply with that subpoena because she had run away some 9 days before. I believe she said that on October 16th of 2007, not October 16th, strike that. She said on January 16th of 2007, she had been picked up for running away from the group home, taken back to the group home, and had run away again. Now, that was why she could not produce a at court. Now, in order to show that there were sufficient efforts to try and locate so that unavailability would be established within the meaning of the Confrontation Clause, the social worker, whose name was Carla Huerta, testified that when she received the subpoena, and she could not, of course, could not honor it, of course, she began to look for, and these are the efforts that she said she made. She said, first of all, what did she do first of all? Well, among the things she did was this. She contacted the juvenile delinquent program, she said, and she gave them pictures of, and she asked them to put something in the paper that would help them locate. Now, it wasn't clear from the testimony whether or not they actually printed the pictures, but if you accept what she said, and the trial court can and did, then you can accept that she did, that the juvenile delinquent program did in fact put something in the paper to that effect. In addition to that, she said because had stayed with her mother many times before, she actually, Carla went out, well actually it's not clear if Carla went out, Carla or somebody working for Carla, maybe both, went to mother's house to look for the young girl, and they were unsuccessful. In addition to that, she said that she contacted the police department and asked them to, if they had heard anything about, and also she testified that they spoke to people on the street, you know, in all in an effort to find in time for trial. An objection was made that this was all a sham. This was not really, they were not really trying to find, they were not looking that hard. That's the essence of the objection that was made in this case. We would respectfully submit that under the existing standard, the standard that this court adopted in State versus Lee, the Supreme, both the ICA and the court below were wrong in concluding that sufficient efforts had been made. As I understand the law, the standard that applies in a situation such as this, in order to determine whether good faith efforts have in fact been made, is, in essence, an objective one. In Lee, this court said that, quote, the prosecution must conduct a search equally as vigorous as that which it would have undertaken to find a critical witness if it had had no prior testimony to rely upon in the event of unavailability. The reason I submit that that standard has not been met is because, as I understand it, this court must view the entire record, not just what Carla Huerta did, but more than that. And the court must view the record with this in mind. Is this prosecutor looking for this witness as vigorously as she would look for this witness if this was the only evidence that she had? I would submit that if you look at the entire record, it doesn't appear to be that way. If the only witness that the prosecutor, if the only way the prosecutor could prove the charges against would have been herself, and if there had been no prior testimony that would have been available, I would submit the prosecutor would not wait 9 days before the start of trial to issue a subpoena. And that is exactly what happened in this case. I would submit that the prosecuting attorney's office would either, the prosecutor herself personally, or maybe someone from her office, and I will confess, I do not know how the prosecuting attorney's office operates on Kauai. I do not know if they have a victim witness kokua section. But be that as it may, one would expect that if a prosecutor has only one witness and only one way of proving all of these very serious charges, the prosecution would have found a way to stay in touch with that young lady from the time the charges, from the time probable cause was found up until the time at the start of trial. Had they done so, they would have found something very troubling. They would have found that on October 16th of 2006, when was taken to the group home, ran away. She ran away three more times after that. Every time they took her back, she would run away within an hour of being taken back. Now, under those circumstances, a prosecutor who knows that, and the prosecutor could only know that by making efforts to stay in touch with her one and only witness, a prosecutor who knew that, one would think, would see to it that there would be no more running, no running away from the program, because if that were to occur, then she would have no case. One would think that a prosecutor under those circumstances would approach the court and request a material witness order so that she cannot keep running away. And would, I would, of course, would have been found to have been a material witness, and they would not have had the problem they had when they served a subpoena 9 days before trial, I'm sorry, 11 days before trial, and only to discover that their witness was no longer available. The other thing that is troubling is what the prosecutor did in this case once she discovered that it was no longer available. While it is laudable what the social worker did in this case, the question is, what did the prosecutor do in this case? If you look at this case through looking at a prosecutor who has this only one witness to prove her case, would she rely only on the efforts of a social worker to try and find this missing witness? I would submit respectfully and reasonably, no. Prosecutor would be involved in the search. The prosecutor would not sit back and let a social worker do all of the looking. The prosecutor would have her own staff out there looking. The prosecutor would contact the police and ask the police to help directly. Prosecutor did not do that. That does not present the picture of a prosecutor who's trying very hard to find the one and only witness under the Lee standard. The other thing that is troubling is once it becomes apparent that this prosecutor does not have her witness, a prosecutor who has only that one witness and no prior testimony to fall back on, one would think would approach the court and say, look, I have a problem. Trial is just a few days away, and I don't have my witness. Without this witness, I cannot proceed. We would like a continuance. The prosecutor did not do that. So if you look at what the prosecutor did in this case, under the standard that this court adopted in the Lee case, it does not appear that this prosecutor made the kind of efforts that a prosecutor who had only this one witness with no fallback testimony to, or no testimony to fall back in terms of prior testimony, that What the prosecutor did not meet that standard.
Counselor, are you saying as a matter of law, the prosecutor can't rely on the social worker in this case? I mean, as you recounted, the social worker contacted the juvenile delinquent program, which printed something in the newspaper, went to the mom's house, contacted schools, asked many people in the community, and contacted the police to see what they'd said or heard of her. What are you saying as a matter of law it was unreasonable to rely on the social worker who was, after all, familiar with this child and where she might be found, what her habits would be, and what methods of investigation might be most effective?
In terms of the confrontation clause, I think what is important is this. Because that is one of the most important rights, the most fundamental rights for ensuring a fair trial is the right to confront and cross-examine your accuser, I would say yes. Because to preserve the integrity of what was done in this case, you'd want to know what the prosecutor did. Is the prosecutor who is the proponent? And you'd want to know, is this prosecutor presenting a picture of someone who's looking diligently for someone who, if not present, would deprive the defendant of his very essential right to cross-examine and confront his accuser? So I would have to say in this case, given the importance of what was at stake, it was not reasonable to only rely on what the social worker did in this case, that the prosecutor's efforts should have started months before under the Lee standard.
So, Mr. Jameson, so you're saying as a matter of law, when should the prosecutor have issued a subpoena?
When?
You're asking us to do that, right? You're asking us to say it was unreasonable to serve it on the social worker 11 days before trial. Weren't you saying that?
I am saying that because...
So when is it? What's the cutoff date?
That's a tough question. If you're the prosecutor and this is your one and only witness...
Well, they had two witnesses.
Well, this is the witness at issue. Well, one thing I can say, not 11 days before. I would say at least 3 months before, because if this girl turns up missing, I need time to find her, you know. If she turns up missing, if she runs away, it may not be that easy to find her. So I need enough of room so that if she does not, if she is missing when I go to serve the subpoena, at least I will have time to find this person before the trial actually starts without impinging on the defendant's right for a speedy trial. So in this case, I would say under these circumstances, at least 3 months before, to give yourself sufficient time.
Mr. Jameson, it seems to me that, well, in Lee, you've referenced that several times, but my recollection of Lee is there was no subpoena issued for the two witnesses that was the problem in Lee. Here we've got a subpoena issued. Does it factor at all that this is a minor involved and it might be more appropriate to have a social worker try and find her as opposed to sending a police officer out to find the witness?
There's nothing wrong with asking the social worker to help, but in terms of what's at stake, I still maintain it is not enough. It is not enough. The prosecutor should be doing more than relying on someone who's not trained, essentially, I would submit, like a police officer would be. Because in Lee, I think, I can't remember what case, but a social worker, I would assume, has other kids to take care of. A social worker is not there to look for missing kids for the prosecution. So I would have to respectfully submit that still relying on a social worker where the complaining witness is a case is not enough, not under the Lee standard. And although a subpoena was issued in Lee, was not issued for two witnesses, there was one for one. In fact, the thing about Lee, as I recall, is the subpoena that was issued, they were able to produce that witness because they got a material witness order with respect to that witness. In the facts of this case, it was screaming for a material witness order, but the prosecutor didn't know what was going on. And again, you come back to Lee. Should the prosecutor in this case have known what was going on? I respectfully submit Yes, because it's, if you look at the Lee standard, okay, you have to look at it as if a prosecutor has only this one witness and no fallback testimony. No witness, no case. You would think, you would know that a prosecutor in that situation would be vigorous in his or her attempts to ensure that that witness will be present for trial. Not wait, and essentially what the record suggests, do nothing until less than 2 weeks before the start of trial. Because at that point in time, it's a little too late.
I wanted to ask you a few questions. One, you argued totality of the circumstances with respect to when a subpoena should be issued. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in the Lee case, in fact, this court indicated that what the prosecution did right was that it moved to have the defendant who showed up at trial, a witness who showed up at trial as a material witness.
That's correct.
And criticized the prosecution for not doing the same thing with respect to the other two witnesses. Is that correct?
That's right.
And in terms of the person in this case, the witness in this case, the Ms. Huerta testified that when she was served with a subpoena, she told the sheriff that she did not have custody of the witness. Isn't that correct?
That's right.
And so the sheriff knew when he served the subpoena on her that she did not have custody of the witness, and the witness was a runaway.
That's right.
And on cross-examination, the defense counsel brought out the fact that the witness could have been detained for trial. She had run away before, and she could have been detained.
Right.
And she was not detained, apparently, because nobody followed up on it.
That's correct.
The social worker was the guardian for the witness in this case.
Yes.
So her relationship with respect to the witness was, she was stood in place, for example, of a parent.
Yes.
So we would be placing the obligation on a parent to meet the burden under this rule that is placed on the prosecution. In other words, the state has the burden of proving that best efforts, good faith efforts, were made to obtain the witness for trial. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But in this case, we would be saying that the person who is in the place of a parent or a parent would have to satisfy that obligation of making best faith or good faith efforts to have the witness appear at trial.
That seems to be the case.
Well, did the prosecution, the police, or any detective do anything with respect to obtaining this witness for trial?
There was some mention, I believe, in the testimony that they talked to the police.
But who talked to the police?
We don't know, and that was one of the...
Well, it certainly wasn't the prosecution or the police talking to themselves, right?
That's correct. So apparently it was the social worker or somebody for the social worker talking to the police.
Okay. So in this case, is there any evidence that the prosecution, through the police or an investigator or detective, made any efforts to have the witness available for trial?
The only thing that the prosecutor did to try and have the witness available for trial is try to serve the subpoena. That's all they did. Nothing else.
On somebody who
actually did not have physical custody of the young lady, but somebody who would know where the young lady was supposed to be.
Do you know of any case that we have under our state law where the effort to produce the witness at trial was done by anyone other than the prosecutor's investigator, the police, or a police detective?
As I stand before you, I have to confess I do not. I wanted to reserve 10 minutes, so if I want my 10 minutes, I better sit down. Thank you.
May it please the court, Tracy Murakami, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the County of Kauai, for the respondent state of Hawaii. I want the record to be clear that on January 22nd, the prosecution filed a motion to sever trial. And the basis for this requested severance was the state knew it was going to have problems locating, but it didn't have that problem locating. So the state said, we want to sever, we want to proceed against, and we want to continue the trial with the victim. And the defense objected in writing, filed a memo and op, objecting to the severance. And then a hearing held on, I believe it was February 1st, 07, so we're four days before trial. The defense again objects, saying the defendant does not want to be subjected to two trials, and he wants to proceed to trial with both victims in 4 days. So although I will admit there were problems, obviously, locating, the state did everything that it could, especially, let's see, January 22nd, we are probably, 11, 12 days before trial, the state is moving to sever, and the defense is objecting. So I want the record to be clear that the defendant wanted to proceed, to trial against all counts, the two victims, with the two daughters. And I just want to reiterate what Carla Huerta did. So Carla Huerta, I believe, is a DHS employee, and she has physical and legal custody of trial is held February 5th, 07. October 30th, 06, starts running away. And I believe she runs away four times between the very end of October and trial, the beginning of February. Carla Huerta testifies that every time she runs away, and she's, I guess they bring her back into the facility, within an hour, she runs away. So they don't have, even when they get her back into the facility, they don't have her for a long period of time. And Carla Huerta testifies that she last was in the facility on January 16th. And Carla Huerta is served with the trial subpoena for her around, I believe, January 23rd. No, I'm sorry, it must have been actually a little bit sooner because the state files its motion to sever on January 22nd. And it's right around there, January 22nd, January 23rd, they serve Carla Huerta. And hasn't been there since January 16th. And even when she was there, she's gone within an hour. So the logistics of actually getting her there, aside from taking her literally into custody, I think it's asking the state to do too much in this case. Defense counsel suggested...
What did the state do, excuse me, aside from...
Okay, so this is via the testimony of Carla Huerta.
What did the state do?
Well, she testifies that she talked to police officers to do their missing person search, and that didn't turn up any leads.
Did she say missing person search?
Well, she says she talked to police officers to see if they saw her.
Right.
That's what she says.
Does the record indicate she asked them to do a missing person's search?
No, and I will admit the record is vague, but I would like to argue that the defendant made no effort to clarify that on cross either.
Is there an obligation under the... defense to clarify?
Well, I think it's unfair now for the defendant to argue, well, it's a little bit vague when he made no effort at trial to clarify those efforts.
Did he argue that it was hearsay, all this was hearsay?
I believe there are no objections to her. Not clarifying, like in appellant's opening brief, he takes issue with Carla Huerta's use of the word we. We contacted the schools, we talked to people in the community, we talked to police officers.
Yeah, he said that was ambiguous.
Correct, but again, no effort to clarify and cross, and the plain meaning of we is I and at least one other person.
Could the witness have been detained?
I believe so, but again, the logistics of 3 months ahead of time, taking a witness into custody, it is simply not practical. We have two courtrooms on Kauai, two circuit court courtrooms. Trial.
Did you move to continue trial?
To sever and then continue the trial with as the victim.
And did you move to declare a material witness?
I don't believe so, no. But again,
so Billy, the charge with respect to Billy is a Class A felony.
Correct.
So
that's correct.
The highest charge against Billy was a Class C felony.
That's correct.
So the most serious offense was the charge against the defendant for, is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And I just want to make the point that it's simply impractical to have the state 3 months ahead of time set trial date. We have two courtrooms, obviously multiple cases set on any given Monday. There are multiple cases set for trial.
Does the prosecutor's office have investigators?
We do. And the final trial date isn't set until about a week or two before trial, that you actually know whether or not you're going to trial. So to ask us to take a witness into custody 3 months ahead of time, it's simply not practical.
When was the last time the prosecutor went out to talk to before?
I'm not sure that's in the record, Your Honor. I don't know.
Did the prosecutor talk? Do you know if the prosecutor did talk to 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 3 months before to prepare her for the trial?
I don't know. I believe the communication is with Ms. Huerta, but in the time leading up to trial, it's not directly with
the prosecutor who was trying the case, who's going to call this witness, spoke in preparation to the witness before the trial.
For trial prep. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I am not certain about that. I know that we had a preliminary hearing. I would guess there was prep before that.
When did the prosecutor learn about the running away?
Well, it's sometime before January 22nd, because that's when the prosecution files that motion to sever, knowing that there were problems with. At the hearing on February 1st, the prosecutor tells the court and defense counsel, we have served Carla Huerta. So the defense attorney is now on notice that she's properly served, that preliminary testimony is coming in. And he had the opportunity to object. He opposed it in writing, and he opposed it at the hearing. So it would be unfair now to say that I don't know what else the state could have done except take her into custody. I think that motion to sever was the proper thing to do at that time, and it was objected to by the defense. So Carla Huerta testifies at trial.
I just wanted to clarify one thing. Yes. So the only thing the state did was to serve a subpoena on a social worker who had legal custody but who had said she was not in her custody and was a runaway.
That's correct. And then she said, Carla Huerta testifies, she contacted the juvenile delinquent program to see if they had any leads, and she said they ran something in the newspaper. They went to mother's home because they had heard that she would stay there periodically. They contacted her school. They talked to people in the community, talked to police officers, see if there were any leads.
What kind of resources did Ms. Huerta have at her disposal, say as compared to the police department or the prosecutor's office, in terms of tracking people down?
I believe she's a DHS employee, so I don't know what kind of resources, but
was her only client, do you know?
I doubt it.
Do social workers, I'm not sure, this isn't in the record, have any training in serving subpoenas, you know, or following through on the service of subpoenas?
I don't know.
What impression do you think, and this is maybe speculation, say a police officer would have on talking to people, say witnesses, say to the mother or to friends of as opposed to a social worker? Do you think that there would be some difference in terms of perception of significance?
But the social worker is in a position of authority like a police officer because she is her legal guardian.
Like a parent?
Correct. But she is a DHS employee. And
Counsel, can I ask you, is there anything in the record to indicate why it was done the way it was done? Why did the prosecutor's office evidently choose to work through the social worker as opposed to through an investigator or a police officer? Does the record reflect that?
It doesn't, and my educated guess is that Ms. Huerta, even though it had been a week since she saw her more than anybody else. And, you know, I'm trying to think, what else could she have done? And defense counsel hasn't said what else she could have done. She talked to the school, police officers, people in the community, and the juvenile delinquent program went to her mother's home. I don't know what else we would have this woman do to try and locate her. And I believe these facts are just like State versus White, in which this court held the efforts were they were adequate efforts and a good faith effort by the state. In that case, it was a detective who testified at trial that the witness Perry had no known job, address, or telephone number. So the detective contacted Perry's mother and had officers check various locations where Perry was thought to have once resided. None of those efforts turned up any leads. I see this case as nearly identical to those efforts.
Well, in White, the police detective had obtained the witness's presence at a prior trial. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And so the same detective was assigned to have the witness for the defendant's retrial. Is that correct?
I'm not certain, but I don't doubt that it is.
And did the police check different places, say, on Oahu and on Lanai, as far as where the defendant had or the witness had previously resided?
I believe it was various locations, so more than one location where Perry had once resided. But again, in this case, they acknowledged she was maybe staying with mom. They went there. They went there more than once. Contacted her school, went to the police, talked to people in the community. Defense counsel hasn't even identified one additional thing that they could have done to locate her. So again, I don't believe there are any other reasonable efforts that could have been made. We could have had a police officer on the stand. I don't know the police officer would have testified to anything more than Ms. Huerta did. And again, I think the trump card for the state here is that the defense attorney objected to the continuance of the trial as the victim. Defendant had the opportunity to continue against her and to go to trial with only his victim. Defense attorney chose not to do that. So I will close that point or with efforts on that note. And going into the adequacy of cross-examination, the majority rule that has evolved since Crawford is looking at the defendant's opportunity to cross at the preliminary hearing. The cross-examination wasn't restricted in any way. He was represented by counsel. His interest at the prelim and at trial, they're identical interests. They're the same charges that he's defending against.
Counsel, does the record indicate whether defense counsel had been provided with any discovery at the time of the preliminary
hearing? The record does not, but, Your Honor, the practice on Kauai is that at arraignment, which happens 3 weeks before the preliminary hearing is held, the defense is given discovery at that time. And I don't believe the arraignment transcript or that hearing was transcribed, but that is the practice that provided at that time.
And that arraignment had already occurred, obviously.
And it was 3 weeks before. The preliminary hearing was actually continued, so it was about a three-week lag in between arraignment and the preliminary hearing.
Like you said, that's not in the record.
It's not. I don't believe that hearing was requested by the defense to be transcribed. I want to also note the defendant hasn't even identified a material line of questioning as to which former counsel should have cross-examined during the preliminary hearing. And so in light of those factors, the overwhelming general rule is that that's an adequate opportunity to cross, and the preliminary hearing testimony was properly admitted. There's the Fry case and the Stewart case defense relies upon, but in those cases we have Colorado and Wisconsin, I believe, by operation of state court rules, restricting cross-examination or the purpose of preliminary hearings. Hawaii does not do that, and that's noted by this court in Fa'afiti. And there was no restriction of cross-examination by the district court judge during the preliminary hearing. So the state would ask this court to apply the general rule that's evolved post-Crawford. I realize Hawaii doesn't have a post-Crawford case admitting preliminary hearing testimony at trial when the witness doesn't appear at trial. This is that case, and the state would ask this court to apply the overwhelming majority rule applied by other jurisdictions.
That the social worker mm-hmm. is like you say that she has a duty to determine where this person is, or she had a duty to because she had, I guess she had custody, right? She
correct.
Awarded custody. That we should hold that the police, in essence, can delegate to the social worker or to a parent, I guess, the job or task of finding this person, the witness, the juvenile, their ward, when they, like in this case, are evading being a witness.
Right.
Do you think that's good policy?
Well, I think there's two things. One, you can say, is Ms. Huerta a social worker? Is she like a parent or is she like a police officer? But I think as an employee of the DHS, she's like both. And I don't think it's fair.
See, that's a question that I have in my mind. You know, in cases like this where there's emotions, I'm sure, that a parent or even maybe the social worker is experiencing, whether this is good for the child to come and testify in court. What the circumstances may be, creating emotions that a police officer would not have in searching for this person and bringing that person to court to testify. I'm not sure if we should hold that when you're looking for a child, you appoint the guardian who has the ability to who is the authority over the child, and hold that person to the same standards as this police officer.
The risk being that perhaps a social worker would be more lenient and understand the child doesn't want to testify.
I think that's possible, you know? I mean, we're a police officer, the prosecutor is actually using this social worker as an agent of theirs, right? To go and bring this child to court to be a witness.
That's correct. I don't have any indication that she was doing anything but her very best effort to actually locate her. And I think these kinds of cases, had been physically and sexually abused by their biological father for years. Their mother chose to believe him. And I think this is a reality, these kinds of cases. You've got a reluctant 14-year-old to come and testify at trial with dads in the courtroom and mom sitting in the gallery. I mean, this is a reality of these kinds of cases.
Mr. Thank Jamieson.
You. Before I move on to my next issue, I'd like to correct something I said earlier. 3 months prior to trial, that'd be unreasonable. The right time to do it is once you find when trial has been set. Once you have your trial date, in this case, because you're dealing with a child who's not living at home, you should know at least the child is with the social worker, and the social worker probably isn't taking the child home, so you should ask the social worker, where is that child? And once, and then you tell the social worker, trial is going to be however much down the line they do it in Kauai. We've got to make sure that she's going to be there. And then somebody from your office should stay in touch with stay in touch with the social worker just to ensure that things are going according to plan. But I'd like to move on to
Mr. Jamieson, could I just clarify, following up on one question or one point that was made by the state? She said that at trial, defense counsel had failed to sort of clarify what Huerta had done or follow up on whether it was adequate. I guess I'd ask a slightly different question, which is, did the defendant preserve the arguments that are being made here today? In other words, at trial, Was there an objection made to the adequacy of the efforts, or was the objection focused on other issues? And in your brief to the ICA, was the objection focused on the issues you're raising today, that it's improper to rely on a social worker, or wasn't the gist of the objection more that her testimony really wasn't admissible because it was hearsay? So I guess my question is, was it preserved both at trial and on appeal, the arguments you're making today?
I believe at trial, the defense attorney renewed his objection to the to the social worker being allowed, to the preliminary hearing being called, being allowed into evidence on the grounds that the whole effort was, to the way he put it, a sham. It's not artful, but it is a way of saying to the court that serving a subpoena on a social worker when they already know the social worker does not have the child in the social worker's custody is meaningless. So, yeah, I would say it was properly preserved at trial.
Mr. Jamieson, oh, I'm sorry, finish answering the question.
Oh, that was it.
What impact does the objection to sever and to continue the trial have in preserving your issue on appeal? Were you just setting up the state? I'm going to object and put you in the situation where you don't have a witness.
But the problem, I think, and I don't know this is not in the record, but you have a client, and the client may not want an appeal. Continuance.
From a legal perspective, and from what's on the record, is it true that the defense attorney objected to a motion to sever and continue?
This is what I did, yeah. I saw that motion to sever. I glanced at it. I should have looked at it more carefully. Had I looked at it, I would not have said what I said earlier, because it would have misled the court, and I think it did. Because I was arguing that the prosecutor should have tried to continue. I did not look at it carefully enough to know that the motion to severance was a motion to continue. But it does raise an important point nonetheless, because if the motion to sever, as the prosecution submits, was filed on January 22nd, the record seems to be clear that the subpoena was served on Carla Huerta on January 25th. So it does appear to be very clear that before they ever went out and served the subpoena, that they knew full well that serving the subpoena was just for the sake of appearance. You know.
So if this trial would have been unfair to your client because the witness was not available, wouldn't it have been, if you're looking for a fair trial, to continue the trial, sever and continue, if your concern is fairness to your client?
That's a tough one, because what if your client wants two things? What if your client wants to go to trial and get this over with? You know, and there's always the chance, too, that the girl, if I understand the record, they picked her up four times before, so that she could have turned up before trial.
Understanding that defense attorneys have it difficult many times, would that waive your objections then if you wouldn't agree to have it, if one of the obvious remedies would be a severance and continuance, and and whether your client wanted to or not, you objected to that?
Not necessarily, because that's only one factor, because, you know, you say you object to a continuance. You still have to look at what did the prosecution present a picture of making vigorous efforts, as vigorous as they would have had they not had the preliminary hearing testimony.
Doesn't Rule 804 require reasonable means?
Yes.
So there isn't a requirement of vigorousness, right? It's a requirement of reasonable means.
Again, looking at what's at stake, I believe what Lee was trying to say was, because the right to confront is fundamental, and you will not have that right to confront if the witness is not there, then every effort should be made by the proponent, the state in this case, to at least present a fair picture that they were vigorous in their attempts to secure the appearance of the witness. And as I said, one thing that they clearly did not do, that I would assume would be done in every case, is when you have witnesses for your case, somebody from either victim witness Kokua or whoever else the Kauai prosecutors have stays in touch with the witness, or if it's a child, the witness's parents or the witness's guardian. So that is something they clearly did not do, and there's no explanation for why they did not do that. And that is something that if you look at it, a prosecutor has to ensure that this witness will be there, or the prosecutor wants to present a picture that I'm doing everything I can to get that witness into the courtroom. Then a prosecutor would have had someone maintain contact with Carla Huerta, and they would have found out months in advance they had a problem, a very serious problem.
Counsel, other reasonable means is the burden placed on the prosecution, not on the defense.
That's my understanding.
Out of Rule 804. The term vigorous attempts, that's our own statement. That is our statement in Lee. Is that correct?
Yes.
Because you win on a motion to severance doesn't mean you waive your right to raise good faith efforts, does it?
That's what I was trying to say. You know, just because we object to the continuance, you still need to look at why isn't the witness here in the first place? Do I have a few minutes?
You have one more minute.
This is the post-Crawford case, which presents a opportunity for this court to re-examine the general rule. The preliminary hearing is not neither the time or place to do discovery or to explore whether or not there is a motive for the witness to lie. Had the defense attorney in this particular case gone into those matters, he may or may not have drawn an objection. The prosecutor, the judge may or may not have allowed it. If the prosecutor said no, and if the judge said, I'm going to sustain the objection, you can't go into motive. I'm going to sustain the objection. You can't find out who else they talked to. I doubt this court would have found that there was error in that case because that would defeat the purpose of the preliminary hearing. State versus Stewart makes a good case for that. It presents the reality of the present rule. In fact, there is not an adequate opportunity to cross-examine the missing witness at the preliminary hearing because the rules of evidence are relaxed. That is, if you attempt to do that, the chances are high that you will not get very far, and you should not get very far, not without defeating the purpose of the preliminary hearing. One final point. If you look closely at this case, there were different interests. At trial, the defense attorney realized after there was now good, strong support that this case was fabricated. The charges may have been fabricated in an attempt to get it out of away from an overly strict parent. At trial, the defense attorney knew that. There is no indication that the defense attorney, who was a different defense attorney, knew that at the preliminary hearing. So they did not have common interests or similar motives in that situation. Had the defense attorney known that, he may have attempted to explore that issue. How far he would have gotten, we can only speculate. What appears to be clear is he did not have that information, so he did not have the same motive or interest at the preliminary hearing that he had, that the defense attorney had at trial. And that is what I believe the rule requires. Thank you.
We thank both counsel, and the court will take this matter under advisement.